Good morning, everyone. So, today is Advent Sunday, and we're starting a new short sermon series for the Advent period. And it's called The Meaning is in the Waiting, The Spirit of Advent. And it's based on a book by the theologian Paula Gooder. And each week, we're going to journey looking forward towards the birth of Christ, starting today with Abraham and Sarah. The meaning is in the waiting. As technology develops, society at large is getting less good at waiting for things. Our expectations of getting things very soon after we decide that we want them have grown phenomenally as companies like Amazon deliver things to our door at amazing speed. At home, we've had examples of products appearing within 12 hours of ordering. Just thought it might be interesting that I got off the internet the explanation for the logo. And it says this. The arrow shape in the logo extends from the letter A to the letter Z, while curving to form a smile, representing customer satisfaction, endless product selection, and end-to-end service. So instant fulfillment all the way from them to us, A to Z. In sharp contrast, my work computer, my laptop, actually the one I used to write this talk, is currently suffering a bit of a slowdown after many years of loyal service. And I'm now having to wait much longer than I'm used to for something to load after I've clicked on it. Familiar? I'm having to get used to watching the little blue circle go round and round in what is sometimes known as the blue circle of death. And it absolutely drives me mad. And I'm sometimes shocked by my own innate intolerance. I'm usually alone in my study, but if someone walked in and suggested to me that there was meaning in the waiting, I'd probably scream at them. But on reflection, there is meaning in the waiting. It's actually the realisation that I've become too impatient and inclined to lose a little bit of self-control, that karmic spirit that you're all used to. And that learning is probably more important than the actual thing that I'm waiting for to load, because often that has very little lasting consequence. And also on reflection, there is meaning in preparing the way for the appreciation that I'm going to feel later towards the IT support person who's going to sort it out for me. Just thought I'd have a quick shout out to any of you who are IT support people out there. Have we got any in the room with us today? Because you are greatly appreciated by those of us who don't know how to do these things for ourselves. There is meaning in the waiting. I'm going to put you out of your misery now and move on to the next slide without things going round and round. There we are. The Christian season of Advent is all about expectation, preparation, and watchfulness as Christmas draws near. But not just the celebration of Christmas. That was Jesus' first coming, which happened 2,000 years ago in the past. We're also preparing for Jesus' second coming, which is in the future. Preparing for Jesus' second coming is the more challenging aspect of the preparation of the Advent season. Because whilst we can confidently count the number of sleeps until Christmas, nobody except Jesus himself can do the same for the second coming. We've no clear idea about the timing, and the Christian faithful have been waiting centuries, which has probably dulled that sense of expectation that the early church had. In our reading this morning from Genesis 18, Abraham and Sarah were both experiencing an acute dulling of that sense of expectation of having a child and heir, because so many years had passed and they had grown so old. Verse 10, then one of them, meaning effectively the Lord, said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son. Abraham and Sarah were were already very old, and Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, "After I am worn out and my Lord is old, will I now have this pleasure?" There's a real sense of, "You what? Don't make me laugh," in Sarah's response. Now, it might seem tempting for us to think unfavourably about Sarah compared to her husband Abraham, who we tend to think of as that great father of the faith. But actually, we only have to scroll back one chapter to Genesis 17, when Abraham received a similar prophecy from God. And it says, "Abraham fell face down. He laughed and said to himself, 'Will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? In truth, they had both laughed, as they had become so hardened by the disappointment of the years of waiting that had brought out in a very human way that they allowed their worldly expectations to overtake what God had promised for them. Have you ever been in that situation where you've been waiting and hoping for so long for something that you've earnestly prayed for, that like Abraham and Sarah, you put up a defensive wall to cover your disappointment and your doubt? But if there's something like that going on for you right now, it might be good just to bring it forward in prayer ministry this morning after this talk. To understand what had brought Abraham and Sarah to this point, we need to explore their backstory in the preceding chapters. So I'm almost a bit like some of these TV series do. I'm going to go back in time and then bring us back forward to the present of the passage that we've read. So, Genesis 12 is where it starts. And the Lord has called Abraham, or Abram as he was then called, at the age of 75, to leave his country, Haran, and all that was home to him, and go to a new country the Lord would show him, where he said, "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing." And once he got there, the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." Now Abraham had shown great faith to do as the Lord had asked him to do by going to this new land. So he must absolutely believe God's promises, including the requirement for him to have offspring to become a nation. The problem was that, as we were told in the previous chapter, Genesis 11, verse 30, now Sarai, that's Sarah by her previous name, was childless because she was not able to conceive. So Abraham must have wondered how his promised offspring would actually come about. A bit further on, in Genesis 15, after a few adventures, when Abraham had learned to trust in God, he's still troubled by the thought of his succession. The Lord has said in a vision that the Lord will be your very great reward. And Abraham responds, "Sovereign Lord, what can you give me, since I remain childless? And the one who will inherit my estate is Eliezer of Damascus. You have given me no children, so a servant in my household will be my heir." But the Lord comes back with this very specific promise: "This man will not be your heir, but a son who is your own flesh and blood will be your heir." He took him outside and said, "Look up at the stars, look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." Then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. That's that great phrase that's repeated by Paul in Romans 4, explaining how we are all children of Abraham through faith. So Abraham has accepted God's word that he will have a son of his own flesh and blood. But he and Sarai must have reflected together that nothing had been said about Sarah being the biological mother. So in Genesis 16, they come up with a cunning plan to go down the surrogacy route. And it says, "Now Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So she said to Abraham, 'The Lord has kept me from having children. Go, sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her.' Abraham agreed to what Sarah said, but it didn't end well. There was no artificial insemination or IVF in ancient times, so Abraham slept with Hagar, and she conceived. And straight after that, perhaps understandably, both women fell out very badly with one another, resulting in God having to send an angel into the desert to rescue the pregnant Hagar, who had been driven out of the home by Sarai. After the angel's intervention, Hagar did return to the home, and in time gave birth to a son called Ishmael. Abraham was now 86 when this happened. In their frustration from a prolonged period of waiting, they had taken the fulfillment of God's promise into their own hands and had jumped the gun on God's plan, which later turned out to be greater than either of them could have imagined. If we're waiting for something which we have committed into God's hands, we need to be watchful that we do not force the timing with our human urgency for fulfillment. It can lead to bad decisions. I remember back in about the end of 2006, I was in need of a new job, and I was out looking for a new job, and this kind of thing quite often happens, but I actually fairly soon got offered a job, and you get that sense of, great, I've got a job, you know, relief. But there was something slightly uncomfortable about it, which I prayed about, and I had a second opportunity coming along, but I hadn't even been interviewed for the second one after I'd been offered the first one. And it was like, you have to either decide. The people behind the first job, you know, said, you've got to make a decision. And actually, I was tempted to go for it, but I had that sense of, no, just wait. So even though I was sort of keeping the uncertainty going, I sort of turned down the first job and hang on and went for the interview for the second one, which in due course I was offered. Looking back, the company who had offered me the first job went bust within 12 months. The second company I still work for today, 15 years later. After a further 13 years of waiting, when Abraham was 99, God's greater plan started to materialize. In Genesis 17, God makes his covenant of circumcision with Abraham. And these are his words. "No longer will you be called Abraham. Your name will be Abraham. For I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you." So there's a lot of emphasis there about succession through descendants. And then, further on in the chapter, God makes it abundantly clear that Sarah, or Sarai, will be the biological mother. It says, "As for Sarai, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. I will bless her, and I will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her, so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her." And this is the point where I'd mentioned earlier that Abraham laughs and queries the prospect of Sarah having a child aged 90. And he tries to revert back to their previous plan by suggesting that Ishmael could be that son. But God's greater plan is going to prevail. "Yes, but your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him." So now everything's clear in terms of what God has said. And I'm coming back now to the time of the passage that we heard earlier. God has appeared at the home of Abraham and Sarah in the form of three visitors to reaffirm that very plan. Verse 10, "Then one of them said, 'I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son.'" And it's now Sarah's turn to laugh, even if only to herself. But God knows our inmost thoughts. We cannot keep them hidden. And the visitor, who is God, knows the truth. Verse 15, "Sarah was afraid, so she lied and said, 'I did not laugh.' But he said, 'Yes, you did laugh.'" But I think the laughter is not just coming from Sarah and Abraham before her. I detect a glint of a smile coming from the Lord when he says to Abraham, "Is anything too hard for the Lord? I mean, is anything too hard for the Lord?" Of course it isn't. And in all the agony of their waiting and the despair of unfulfilled promises, they had lost sight that everything is under God's control and God's timing. We humans cannot force it, and things go badly wrong if we try to. Our calling is to trust in the Lord, who is faithful in his promises, and be patient, knowing that he can do anything, even if we would not think it physically or biologically possible. There's an almost identical response for the Virgin Mary in the Christmas story in Luke 1, when she is visited by the angel Gabriel and told that she will conceive despite being a virgin. When she queries this prophecy, Gabriel responds with the words, "For nothing is impossible with God." How much does that echo and resonate with the words just given to Abraham? Is anything too hard for the Lord? And just as the angel Gabriel's seemingly impossible prophecy to Mary was fulfilled in the birth of Jesus, the prophecy to Abraham and Sarah was fulfilled in Genesis 21, three chapters further on. The chapter opens with these words: "Now the Lord was gracious to Sarah, as he had said. For the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the very time God had promised him. Abraham gave the name Isaac to the son that Sarah bore him." How wonderful. Here we're talking about 25 years after he first had the prophecy when he left Haran. And there's great significance in the name Isaac. In Hebrew, it means laughter. Remember how both Abraham and Sarah had both separately responded to the Lord's prophecies with a disbelieving, mocking laugh. But now, the wait was over. And through God's transformational action, they were now both laughing with pure joy. In fact, it says this, these are Sarah's words in verse 6. "God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me." And she added, "Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age." You can just feel the joy that's coming out with those words. And there's another important thing about names. Sarah's old name, Sarai, when spoken out loud in Hebrew, carried the meaning of the words, "my distress." The Lord knew the transformation that lay ahead for her. When prophesying her pregnancy, he renamed her Sarah, the name by which we remember her centuries later. And Sarah, in ancient Hebrew, means princess. He took away the distress, and he gave her a new name, befitting someone who would be the mother of nations. God had spoken to her during her waiting and given new meaning to her name, her very identity, long before the waiting was over. The meaning in the waiting is that we learn to trust God, to yield to his will and be patient, faithful and expectant. I'm going to close now with these rather insightful words that Paula Gooder uses to finish this chapter in her book. Abraham and Sarah become symbols for us, not only of faith, but also of waiting. Of waiting as an essential part of our journey with God. Of waiting being vital for the proper unfolding of God's plan. And of waiting as being as important as that for which we wait. God summons us to go out, but does not always tell us where to or why. For that we must wait, but in the waiting, we can sometimes discover a meaning. Amen.